And we're beginning. Okay, this week's parsha is one of the it's the next to last parsha of the entire five books of Moshe. Parsha is called Ha'azinu, which means literally to sing. No, listen up, rather. I'm sorry, to listen. Sorry. The title of our class is When Leisure Time Becomes Boring, which will become self-evident as we get onto it. This is we're gonna, the Parsha of Hazinu is largely a poem, which Moshe talks about sort of the arc of Jewish history, and we're going to get into that. But we're going to start from something earlier, and this is a clip. A person made sort of a little bit of a clip based upon Malcolm Gladwell's book, David and Goliath. And in David and Goliath, he has a little section called Parenting Advice. Okay, so we're going to watch that, and then we'll discuss that, and then we'll get that we'll get that thing. We'll go forward. Here we go. We can share the screen. And then here we go.
David and Goliath by Malcolm Gladwell. You would think I'd start this book with a story of David and Goliath, because that's the name of the book. But we all know that story, so I'll talk a little bit about another concept that Malcolm describes in the book. The advantage of a disadvantage, and the disadvantage of an advantage. The relationship between parenting and money. More is not always better. It's hard to be a good parent if you have too little money. That's obvious. Poverty is exhausting and stressful. If you have two jobs to make ends meet, it's hard to have energy to reach your children before they go to bed. If you are a working single parent trying to pay your rent and feed and clothe your family, it's hard to provide your children with constant love and attention when you're working so hard. If you were asked to draw a graph between the relationship of parenting and money, I'm guessing it would have looked something like this. Money makes parenting easier until a certain point when it stops making much difference. Well, scholars who research happiness in families have found out that more money stops making a family happier at around $75,000 a year. When the income of parents get high enough, then parenting starts getting harder again. How do you teach work hard, be independent, learn the meaning of money to kids who look around themselves and realize they never have to work hard again? So a true graph looks like this. Up to about $75,000 a year, money makes parenting easier. From $75,000 a year, it starts getting harder again. If your kid didn't work for it, it wouldn't be worth anything in his eyes. I grew up in a beautiful city that I always took for granted. I would even complain about the city. When I saw a third world country for the first time, I couldn't believe my eyes, how much I took for granted where I grew up in. To have wealth and still give your children good education, you have to learn to say, no, I wouldn't buy this for you. Instead of a regular parent who would say, no, I can't afford it. It's much harder to say to your kid, I can't give you money when you're driving a Ferrari. You should say, yes, I can buy this for you, but I choose not to because it contradicts my values. With school.
Okay, I'll take that little piece. All right, let's go back to the share. Okay, we're going to. Okay. So who could just sort of summarize? How do you explain that more money does not increase parenting and happiness in general?
It just creates different problems.
All right. In what sense?
It's kind of like what he says, like, you know, whether you're making 75,000 or you're making 100 million, it's a whole new set of problems. I mean, you deal with the same stuff that people make that make 55,000. It's just, you know, maybe a grander scale, I guess, you know, trying to teach your kids, you know, the worth of money and allowance that, like, you know, just because I drive like a fancy car doesn't mean you're automatically going to get a car when you turn 16. Like, you have to earn it.
Right.
You have to be, like, responsible.
Right. So if a person is middle class, the child's not going to get the car because the parent can't afford the car.
Right.
So there's no problem. But if the parent is very wealthy and it's self-evident that the parent can afford the car, the question is, by what virtue is the parent saying no to the child? So that demands of the parent what? What does that demand of the parent to have in order to be, if you are wealthy and you have all the, you have these options, what is the demand of the parent?
You have to make sure you instill a sense of like a code, I would say. Okay. You know what I mean? Like a, like ethics.
100%. So how, but how are you going to do that?
Leading by example, I would guess, right?
So that's actually a little bit tricky. So let's say the parent has bought themselves, well, I don't know if necessarily a Ferrari, but a very fancy car. So the child can say, well, you made money and you have a fancy car. Why don't you want to give me a car? I don't need a fancy car, but why can't I get a basic car? So, you know, you're going to have, it's not just simply that you have the rules, but you have to have a clear, the challenge is the more money you have, the more choices you have. And unless you have the wisdom to navigate those choices, you're likely to make mistakes, A. Second challenge is that not only do you have to have, if you said you have to have a code, but you actually have to live by that code. So kids are geniuses of detecting your true principles. Kids don't listen to what you have to say, but they are watching you and they see what you really, your true intentions are.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is that if the parent is spending time and they're, indulging themselves. So if you're indulging yourself, why can't I indulge myself? You know, what's the comeback on that?
Right.
Anybody want to jump in on that? Agree, disagree?
I agree.
All right, Michael Dodds.
Okay. Restate succinctly, what is it I need to agree or disagree with? I didn't quite.
Well, in other words, the challenge of parenting when you have more than, in other words, the number of 75,000 is not, I mean, the precise, it means that the fundamental basic needs, food, clothing, shelter, insurance, you know, which in the Jewish community probably doubled that, but whatever. In the New York area at least, or a lot more than $75,000. But whatever that number is, that middle class number, okay? The extra money starts to create problems. And the problems are, and the question, well, first of all, what other problems does the extra money cause?
They expect things. They don't.
Right, so that gets into, so you have, why do they expect things? All right, let me hear some other people. Shayna.
So I can actually kind of speak about this firsthand. Growing up was when my father was first starting his company. And so we didn't always get, we meaning my brother and I, didn't always get what we wanted. It had to be things that would help us as children grow up to become better adults. We could have the instrument lessons to help us do better in school and for that development, but we couldn't always have the newest toy or something like that. And now that my father has an established business, my 8-year-old half-sister lives in a house that's completely different from the house that my brother and I grew up in, and she can have pretty much anything and everything that she wants. And the hardest part is when you see mommy coming home with new shopping bags of clothes every day, is how do you tell someone who can have everything in the world, no, you can't have this?
Right. So you have to have a good reason. Right. And if so, that gets into the problem of what is the definition of a spoiled child? And conversely, what is the problem of a spoiled child?
They demand things. They don't ask for things. They say, you know, buy me this. Don't, like, can I have this? I'll work a second job. I'll do chores around the house. You know, they demand things. They don't ask for things.
Right, because they have what they call, they have an intrinsic sense of entitlement that all the good stuff, whatever they desire, they are intrinsically entitled to.
A child who learns no boundaries on what they want.
They learn no boundaries. What other problems is that going to cause for the person?
That they don't understand what the word no means. They expect that if they want it, they're going to get it.
Right, and what's the problem with that?
They throw fits when you say no.
Okay, so fine. But is that the ultimate problem? You hear from Dan Lastman. Dan, what do you think?
Adults, so it can teach you in business, your personal relationships. There's lots of other times when, you know, professionally, people can't always say yes, you have to learn like that.
Dan, the connection's not so good. We can't hear you so well.
Sorry, can you hear me better now?
Way better.
Okay. I was saying, and when you get older as an adult, you still don't understand what no means. So, like, in a personal or professional setting, people, you know, sometimes have to say no to you when you're asking for different things, and you have to learn how to kind of take that in stride and keep working towards your goal and, you know, have a more dynamic relationship with your challenges than just, you know, demanding for them to be solved. You have to kind of learn how to work through things.
100%. Dan's 100% correct. In other words, reality can't possibly conform to, even if the parent has infinite resources to provide the child with all their wishes, they are not going to be met when they leave their house, because they're going to work in a job where mommy and daddy are not there generally, and they're going to be told, this was not a good job, you cannot do this, you must stay late, you know, you're not getting the raise, whatever the we live in a world of no as an adult. It's about, you know, and they're going to not be able, they're going to basically, the parent is not preparing the child for reality, to become an independent adult. It's a disaster. So let's put it all into order. Step one, the parent has the money. Money provides new choices. The choices are great if you have the wisdom to navigate those choices. If not, it's going to go to the lowest common denominator, which is just basically indulging themselves in whatever they like, food and clothing and entertainment, and you know, as more of an adult, what about, you know, partying and all of its elements. And therefore, the child who sees the parent who is indulging themselves will rightly say, well, why can't I, if you're indulging yourself, why can't I indulge myself? And the challenge is that the indulged child has no work ethic, has no sense of the challenges of actually having money, managing money, maintaining money, and then is not prepared to deal with the reality of both in relationships and work, where the reality of no, where disappointment, where setback, where crisis is a regular phenomenon. The parent has done the child a profound disservice. So we have three questions. So going back to what Malcolm Gladwell's point is, if the person's poor, that's bad because they're not getting the basic necessities of life. That's very stressful. when they hit the sort of middle class point, they're basically taking care of their basic needs, and they get a, you know, small amount of, let's say, call it, you know, basic luxuries. Let's say they, as the family, can go out to eat to, out to dinner for maybe once a week or every other week, or go see a movie, but nothing dramatic. And any kind of extra things that the kid wants, the parent can't provide because they simply don't have the resources. Then we'll add $25,000, $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 to the family income. Now there's all this discretionary income. Now the question is, how are you going to navigate that? And if the child says, well, I want to have a new, I want the iPhone 10, and, you know, and I want to have, and the question is, you know, what do you give them, and give them or not give them? On one hand, they're your child. You certainly want to give them stuff. But I think what Shane has said is a good rule of thumb. You give them material which is helpful for them to grow to become independent, healthy adults, and no more. You can say no to the child. Say, look, I don't. You didn't earn it. You don't get it because that's not reality. That's not the way the world works. Okay. So that's the key thing. So then, I want to bring up another concept. What does wealth also provide for the person in general? In addition to choices and opportunities, what other benefit does money provide a person?
Power and influence.
Power and influence.
It's one... One last thing you have to think about, like, you don't have to worry about where, you know, next month's mortgage or rent's going to come from.
Right. So you have a measure of security, provides a measure of security, right? That the basics of life are taken care of. What else? One of the greatest luxury of having discretionary income is the phenomenon of leisure time. It's just a sort of a commentary on America that...
Like, you can take vacation, like, right, you don't have to work on the weekend.
You don't have to work around the clock. Although, for most wealthy people, they are working more than the average middle-class person. But theoretically, the person was just trying to, make money to provide a basic lifestyle, not an extravagant lifestyle, that person would be able to support themselves and have more leisure time. Okay?
There have been studies that people who make below a certain threshold are willing to mortgage more time for money to have happiness, and people who make above a certain amount are willing to spend more money to get more time.
Makes sense.
So say that again. The people who are below
around 75,000, below 75,000,
okay,
are more willing to mortgage time to get more money. They're willing to invest more time at the office. They're willing to do what it does to have more security. Right. Above around 75,000, people start investing their money more and saving more of their time.
Right. The smart ones. Now, what's... Here's my question to you all, and this is sort of part of our grand introduction to our parsha. What is the definition of leisure time?
Relaxing or doing whatever you want.
Doing whatever you want. Okay. When does leisure time become boring?
When you're not, you know. I don't know. I can't think of it.
Okay. Who's got a comment on that? Sean? When does leisure time become boring? And then I want to hear from Suzanne.
I don't know. When it's not fun, when you're not doing something that interests you?
Yeah. You're not getting anything out of it.
Okay.
Okay. Suzanne, you want to add to that?
When is it boring? Yeah, I guess when it's not sparking your interest, then it's not kind of lighting you up. You're just, I don't.
Right. So leisure time, the ability to enjoy yourself, presupposes the capacity for the, in other words, when you're working, you're using your energy to take care of your agenda, do the various chores, the obligations, the tasks, right? So that reservoir of energy gets dissipated based upon all the hassles of and responsibilities of the job, okay? Now, let's take Sunday. Sunday, now you have the same reservoir of energy, but you have the ability to spend, some or most of it, or maybe all of it, on whatever interests you. But what's the problem? The problem is that the activity is not sufficiently compelling, interesting, absorbing to allow you to direct your energy. So what happens? What happens when people get bored? You've all been bored. Hopefully not bored now, but you know. Okay. What happens when people get bored?
They take a nap.
Okay, that's one solution. Nap taking?
They overeat.
Right now.
They don't do good things.
It's not productive.
Right. So what happens is they start going down to the lower form of human activity to try to absorb the energy. So that's when they start getting into trouble. So either they're eating or overeating. Or another activity when people are bored is drinking to excess, partying, sexual activities which are not healthy or helpful. That's why, too much leisure time is viewed as a bad thing because, again, it's the same problem. If you have the wisdom to dedicate your leisure time properly, well, great. Like some people can, really get absorbed by a book. Now I'm not talking about a fictional novel, which is a kind of which is basically a reading a movie, essentially, which is actually providing a sense of ideas and insight into the human experience. Well, that's some kind of, but most people can't do that, and they get very fretful and anxious, and it's actually having too much time is a source of anxiety. And just the opposite. So a classic American way of solving that is, well, answer more emails, do more work time, make work time all the time, don't get off the rat race. At least, because what it does is it's soothing because it at least absorbs the energy, which if it's not going productively will go into a lot of unhelpful activities. Okay.
A lot of people who retire, then after a while, they find that they're bored.
Right. That's it. It's not a good, in other words, for most people, retirement or having long periods of leisure time is a disaster. It's a disaster. And it's certain, we're going to get into that more deeply. Okay. This is sort of an introduction. All right. Now I'm going to do as I do always, we started. I'm now going to ask you guys to look, and I'm going to put on the screen here, and I sent you guys the 18 verses of Hazinu. Take a look at it. I'm going to stop the pause the recording for a moment. Yes, go ahead.
In the English, with all the punctuation between exclamation points and question marks and commas, semicolons, and periods, when you go back to the Torah, there is no punctuation.
Yes.
So how in the English translation do we know what markings to use?
That's an excellent question. The basic answer is that every translation is an interpretation. So now there might be an interpretation that everybody agrees with, but we're going to give you an example of, in verse 5, there's at least two possible translations of the Hebrew, and therefore the punctuation is actually completely different. So it's not, the answer is we don't know, and this is just this translation by Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan. I just like it. He made it into a very readable translation. Now you see all the phrases that are highlighted. Right, there's hyperlinks and all over the page here. You see that?
Yeah.
So what does it, what if you would click it in your own on your own computer, it'll take you to his the website, which has all the stuff, which gives you he in his notes provide alternate translations. Okay, so his in the hyperlink is this is the reading he's going with, but he also was going to cite in that particular there's alternate variant translations. Okay, especially this is basically a poem, so when you deal with poetry, it's even more not precise. You know what I'm saying? Is that clear?
Yeah.
Good question. All right, so let me just start with a basic question. Who could just summarize? Let's talk in the first 18 verses. Who could summarize what's going on here?
It seems like Moses is lecturing or yelling at the people, that he's wondering how they could, I guess, veer off the correct path, knowing where their history is and knowing what Hashem has done for them within their history.
Now, is he talking about the Jewish people who are with him in the plains of Moab, who are about to enter the land of Israel?
It doesn't seem like it.
No. Are you talking about the generation that dies in the desert?
Well, by the way, is itself is not, in other words, if you look from the previous thing, a previous chapter, Moshe says, you're going to give this Shira, this song for you to put in everybody's mouth to learn, and you'll have the Torah, which will be a testament of this thing. And as such, this is really talking about a future forecast of Jewish history. He's not going to be, so one reading from the context of the previous chapter, chapter 31, is he's telling them what's going to befall the Jewish people. There's a cycle going on here. What's going to be happening? What's it eventually going to happen?
We always fail.
But it's in a very specific circumstance. Go ahead. What will be the challenge that's going to be the most? What's going to be the challenge that's going to be most struggling for the Jewish people, which Moshe is revealing to them?
Idolatry?
Well, that's how they fall into that, but what's the precursor to that?
They get God's benefit and then forget where the benefits come from.
So, specifically, what kind of benefit are they talking about?
Physical. Sustenance.
Right, they're going to have robust wealth. Let's take it on to verse 13. He carried them over the earth's highest place to feast on the crops of the field. He let them suckle honey from the bedrock, oil from the flinty cliff. They had the cheese of cattle, milk of sheep, fat of lambs, rams of Bashan, luscious fat wheat. They drank the blood of grapes for wine. You sure and thus became fat and rebelled. You grew fat, thick, and gross. The nation abandoned the God who made it and spurned the mighty one who was its support. They provoked his jealousy with alien practices, made him angry with vile deeds. They sacrificed to demons who were non gods, deities they never knew. These were new things, recently arrived, which their fathers never considered. You thus ignored the mighty one who bore you, forgot the power who delivered you. So it's really talking about the challenge of wealth. basically telling them the Jewish people are going to enter the land of Israel. They're going to set up a state, right? And they are going to, they're going to become wealthy and forget about God. Okay? And they're not only going to, they're going to end up doing the practices of the regional power. They're going to copy the, their Gentile neighbors. Okay? Is that clear? Just as a sound now, as an introduction to that, in his first, let's go back to verse 5. All right, let's read it out. All right, Sean?
Is corruption his? No. His children's is the blemish, a generation crooked and perverse. Alternatively...
So stop right there. So therefore... So what basically Moshe is telling the Jews as a forecast, when bad things occur, you're going to ascribe what? It's God's fault, right? So one way of reading that pasuk is that the corruption is coming not from God, but from the Jewish people themselves. That's one reading. What's another reading?
A crooked generation who are not his sons has disregarded him, this being their defect.
All right, so it goes a little deeper about their, the Jewish people get to a point, how far gone do the Jewish people get, as Moshe is going to forecast? Now, the end of the Zeno has a good ending, but whatever. But right now, how far gone? According to the second...
They're so far off that they're not even like related, not even his sons anymore.
That's it. That's the farthest you can go. That's it. There's a divorce. Which religion made this claim?
Christianity.
Christianity, and they say the Jews, because of the rejection of Jesus and the saving grace of Jesus Christ, therefore they have lost the ability. They're no longer the sons of God. They're not the children of Israel, and the Christians are the new children of Israel. They've been replaced. It's called replacement theology. Okay? Let's take a look at this is the way of reading it from the Ibn Ezra. We're gonna go down. Okay. I'm gonna have somebody else read. I'm gonna have Moshe Chaim Dodes read.
Sure.
And I'm gonna make it a little bit bigger because now, first of all, who is the Ibn Ezra? Ibn Ezra was a guy who lived around the year 1000, the same time of Rashi. And he was Sephardic. He was from Spain. He did a lot of travels. And he wrote an extensive commentary on the Tanakh. And he takes a very grammatical-oriented approach. The Rambam, who lived, 150 years later, viewed him as being the primary commentator on the Chumash. Okay, let's go. Let's go ahead and get Moshe Chaim. Read his explanation.
Okay, what does he mean by not his sons, or does it mean? Those who say that they are not his sons compare sons that are not trustworthy with the meaning.
So it says later on, in the same song, it says, sons were not trustworthy. Go on.
The meaning of the phrase is that they do not acknowledge him as their creator, or if they acknowledge him on their lips, they do not acknowledge him in their heart, as evidenced by their not fearing God.
Let's stop right there. So he says, in what sense are they no longer his sons anymore? Because what are they basically, the Jews, at what point do the Jews get to?
Lip service.
Well, either they deny him as a creator. So really, what they become atheists, or they don't become atheists externally. They will say all the, religious, they'll talk about God a lot, but internally, what do they really feel?
He's not the creator or all powerful.
Right, and basically, right, they're not ascribing any source of their success or their to them. All right, go on. I'm going to skip the
Skip the lament.
A lot of grammatical thing. Go into, in my opinion, see where I have over here?
Yeah. In my opinion, however, the correct interpretation is as follows. The object of the waste is God. In other words, they have perverted the ways of God, which are innate, as well as the decrees which he has commanded. As if the verse had read, a crooked generation who are not his sons has disregarded him, this being their defect. This interpretation is confirmed by the subsequent verse, shall you render this to God?
Right. So basically, so this is what is the level of decay between the relationship between God and the Jewish people that Moshe is forecasting? First of all, better yet, let me back up. What is the metaphor of the relationship which is at play here? And we're going to, and that of course ties in very nicely to our, we have Rosh Hashanah coming up tomorrow night. What metaphorical relationship is this playing off? Is this a riff off? One way of perceiving the relationship between God and man is what?
Father and children?
Father and children is correct. So if you're talking about an extreme case of rebellion, or how is Moshe depicting it? It's as if what?
They say, you're not my father.
Right. So it's an absolute betrayal. Or this, the highest level of the where the Jewish people get to the lowest point is basically the deny, according to the Ibn Ezra, they're denying God as their father, and basically a complete denial, a complete estrangement. Now, in order to get a better flavor of the, now this idea of God being the father and the Jewish people being either, there's two metaphors in Tanakh, either being the wife who cheats on God, like a woman who becomes a prostitute. That's, we find that in the book of Proverbs and the book of other books in the prophet. Also, the Jewish people are the sons who betray the father, okay? Now, one of the most greatest stories of betrayal of the father is found in the story of Avshalom, and to his father, King David, okay? Let's have some reading of the story. It's a great story, and I cut out a lot of it, but all right, Shannon, read it out.
Absalom did this to every Israelite who came to the king for judgment. Thus, Absalom won away the hearts of the men of Israel.
All right, stop right there. So Absalom is one of the children, you know, that King David has many sons, has many wives, 18. One of the, and the oldest and the most, the most distinguished son is a son named Absalom, who the prophet says earlier in the book of Samuel 2 is very good looking, and he's distinguished, and people come for him for judgment. And he's starting to ascribe the role, his dad's getting older, okay? And he's starting to assume the role of natural leadership. He's going from a prince to a king. Go on.
After a period of 40 years had gone by, Absalom said to the king, let me go to Hebron and fulfill a vow that I made to the Lord. For your servant made a vow when I lived in Geshur of Aram. If the Lord ever brings me back to Jerusalem, I will worship the Lord. The king said to him, go in peace. And so he set out for Hebron.
All right, so by the way, you see over here that Hebron is being a source of service, as being a holy place, you see depicting here, because he's going from Jerusalem to Hebron. Okay? Let's go on.
But Absalom sent agents to all the tribes of Israel to say, when you hear the blast of the horn, announce that Absalom has become king in Hebron.
All right, so what really was going on there? Was he going to pray? Was he going to do service of God? What was he going to Hebron for? This is very Games of Thrones-y. Okay, well, this is where Games of Thrones got. I mean, this is classic. This is, the Bible. This is, you can't get any better than this. You know, where did Shakespeare get all of his great stuff? A lot of stuff is coming from these great stories from the Bible. So he's going to pray, and he sort of fooled his dad, his old elderly dad, King David. What's he really trying to do?
Take over from him and become the next king.
Right, even though what?
David is still alive and Hashem hasn't appointed the next king.
Correct. Go on.
200 men of Jerusalem accompanied Avshalom. They were invited and went in good faith, suspecting nothing. Avshalom also sent Achitophel, the Gila knight, David's counselor from his town, Gilo, when the sacrifices were to be offered. The conspiracy gained strength, and the people supported Avshalom in increasing numbers.
Okay, so I just cut out a big chunk. All right, keep on going.
Someone came and told David, the loyalty of the men of Israel has veered toward Avshalom. Whereupon David said to all the courtiers who were with him in Jerusalem, let us flee at once, or none of us will escape from Avshalom. We must get away quickly, or he will soon overtake us and bring down disaster upon us and put the city to the sword.
Stop right there. Again, we're talking about what did King David, Avshalom's father, realize? This is epic.
That Avshalom's trying to take over and none of them will be able to escape him.
Going to be fascinating.
From an emotional content, what does that mean?
His son has rebelled against him.
And he's even willing to do what?
Kill the whole city?
Yes, including his own father. He knows that he's got to make an escape. He's got to gather his troops to make an escape, or else he's going to be what? Dead. All right, keep on going.
The king's
you understand what the magnitude of that is? That you have a son who you have cherished, who you have raised in, you know, you're raised as a prince. You've given him everything, okay? He's a well-respected guy. And he has a desire to take over, and he's willing to create a coalition of the willing. And people are now loving Avshalom because he's a good-looking dude. He looks like the part. He's like the younger version of King David. He's like King David version, 2.0. And what does David recognize?
He's already lost power, basically.
No, lost power, but his own son has betrayed him and is going to willing to kill him. I mean, it gets even worse. Let's go on.
The king's courtiers said to the king, whatever our lord the king decides, your servants are ready. So the king left, followed by his entire household, except for 10 concubines whom the king left to mind the palace. The king left, followed by all the people, and they stopped at the last house.
Right, so you guys were all there. Those were on the Israel trip. You guys went to Ir David. That's where he left. His palace was there. And he left 10 of the women to, to manage the house. Okay?
Why do we need to know that? Just curious.
We're going to find out. It'll be very important. It's a very important fact coming up. Go on.
As King David was approaching Bahurim, a member of Saul's clan, a man named Shimei, son of Gera. Shimei, son of Gera, came out from there, hurling insults as he came. He threw stones at David and all King David's courtiers, while all the troops and all the warriors were at his right and his left. And these are the insults that Shimei hurled. Get out, you criminal, you villain. The Lord is paying you back for all your crimes against the family of Saul, whose throne you seized. The Lord is handing over the throne to your son, Avshalom. You are in trouble because you are a criminal.
Okay, keep on going. I cut out some of the stuff, but it was late. Go on.
David and his men continued on their way while Shimei walked alongside on the slope of the hill, insulting him as he walked and throwing stones at him and flinging dirt. The king and all who accompanied him arrived exhausted and he rested there.
Okay, so not only does he have to endure the tremendous depressive thought that his own son is going to be doing a coup d'etat, is going to try to kill him and take over, then the one of the members of King Saul's clan who he took over from views this as, who is rejoicing on the fact that King David is going to get nailed by his own son, and says, and uses the fact that he's now, that King David is weakened, to insult him, throw rocks at him, and etc. So it's like completely, not only getting betrayed, but you're getting insulted. You know what I mean? It's like, it's going from bad to worse, like emotionally, like crushing. Okay, go on.
Meanwhile, Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, arrived in Jerusalem, together with Ahitophel, when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, came before Absalom. Hushai said to Absalom, "Long live the king, long live the king."
All right, so I'm skipping some stuff. Go on.
Absalom then said to Ahitophel, "What do you advise us to do?" And Ahitophel said to Absalom, "Have intercourse with your father's concubines, whom he left to mind the palace. And when all Israel hears that you have dared the wrath of your father, all who support you will be encouraged." So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and Absalom lay with his father's concubines with the full knowledge of all Israel. In those days, the advice which Ahitophel gave was accepted like an oracle sought from God. That is how all the advice of Ahitophel was esteemed both by David and Absalom.
Okay, so what does Ahitophel, who's this very slick guy, advise him to demonstrate that he's in charge?
To have intercourse with the 10 concubines left to manage the palace.
Right. So why is that? Why is that? Why will that be a deciding factor?
It's embarrassing to his father.
Well, more than that, what is the political significance of that?
He's not afraid of any repercussions.
Right. So if he's sleeping with the king's concubines, and there's nobody opposing him, what essentially has he effectively done?
Taken over.
He's taken over. Everybody realize that there's a new king, and it's Absalom, because he's basically, David has scampered out, like, you know, and Absalom has moved in into the palace and he's taken over. Okay. I encourage you to go on to Samuel 2, beyond chapter 18, to find out what happens. It's dramatic.
Very, very Game of Thrones.
It is. But no doubt the writers who are thinking about these kind of, you know, they're getting from sort of a Shakespearean, you know, struggles, which of course Shakespeare himself knew the Bible cold. So all these kind of stories, the great stories of King David and, you know, him trying to manage his unruly palace and princes and fighting and rapes and assassinations, everything. The king is amazing. So it's coming from the thing. But now let's bring it back. You know, let's bring this, the relevance, to us in 2017, because our idea, whenever we learn the Parsha class, is our goal is to be able to take aspects of the Parsha to apply to our own lives. Okay, so I brought the example of, in Tanakh, arguably the greatest betrayal of a son to a father, okay? Would you agree this is an extreme case of a betrayal?
Yes.
Yeah, this is the most, on the betrayalometer, this is a full 10. It doesn't get any more intense than this. Okay, so here's the thing. Naturally, Absalom feels extremely entitled. He's basically a spoiled prince, who, because he had the desire to take over, he basically orchestrated a scheme and used and then built his coalition. He was doing it for many years, and he was able to be seemingly successful. And he had Not only that, who was his counselor?
David's counselor.
Right, but apparently this guy, Achitofel is viewed as a guy who is extremely insightful. He's like in the Democratic Party, James Carville has been an advisor for many, many Democratic candidates, congresspeople, senators, and of course presidents. He's the kind of guy that who has a tremendous political sense. Achitofel is like James Carville on steroids. He's like unbelievable. So much so, like his insight is like from God. Okay, that's the level of. So basically, it's interesting. Avshalom's downfall is that he does not listen to Achitofel. But that's a little foreshadowing. I don't want to spoil the rest of the story. Here's the deal. See, the first thing, and this really gets to, we're right now on the doorstep of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and our minds are going to be focused upon ourselves and growing. And the first thing is that as a child, all of us are children, you know, do we take the gifts that our parents have given us for granted? So in the story of Avshalom, we have an extreme case. And God in Moshe is telling the Jewish people that the Jewish people will get to a point where they take all the tremendous blessings in their world and it ultimately becomes used in a certain sense against God. Okay? It's the ultimate betrayal. So it's the ultimate betrayal. So the first thing is that the first step to neutralize that tendency in man is the phenomena of course, recognizing the blessings are not coming from our own strength, you know. And first of all, to appreciate our parents who probably with a great deal of sacrifice provide you a home, an education, good values, which you have taken and extended. And some people on the call have children, some people do not yet have children, but the bottom line is when you're raising your kids, to not raise the child with a sense of entitlement, with a sense of it's all coming to me. Because basically that sense of entitlement allows bad things to occur. It allows the person to just act out on all their most primitive feelings, and you know, because they feel like the entitled prince. They feel like Avshalom, and they feel like everything is deserved to them, and it leads to very extreme immoral behavior. That's three. And then on the more mundane element, part of the challenge of life is using the gift that God gives us, which is leisure time. But really the model of the ideal leisure time is really what? Shabbat and Yom Tov. So Shabbat, we have good meals. You're not stressed out about your job. You step off the rat race for 25 hours. And the question is, are you going to use that time effectively for, you know, learning, what could be visiting the sick, like we like to have at MGE, time to engage with the community, strengthen my relationship with my family, engage in thoughtful conversation, or am I going to just either A, go back to extend the rat race to its seventh day, or B, just use the time to just engage in further, engorging myself on food or other things because I'm bored. And the mission of our greatest luxury that money provides, and that is the greatest asset that everybody has, is time. And the biggest struggle, especially in our day and age, is using time effectively. We have so much distractions. The phone alone, with Instagram and Facebook and YouTube, could just eat up the discretionary free time a person has, and then any kind of thoughtful growth that the person has been used up because the person was bored and, you know, just went from one video to the next video. And then, you know, when they could have used the time more effectively. Now, obviously, balancing, you have to be, there is downtime. You have to be, you know, thoughtful about that. But the key challenge that we, that is to use the luxury time, the leisure time in a thoughtful way versus not to get bored and then just spill into low-end distractions or, God forbid, into drinking and, you know, various unhealthy behaviors. And that really is the challenge of to serve God when you're poor is the Jewish people in the Middle Ages were poor, and it was a time of actually quite a tremendous growth. And when we now in 2017, we're Jewish people that are, as a Jewish people, our struggle, our challenge is a Judaism when we have wealth. How do we use those blessings? How do we use the free time? How do we use our energies? It's not so simple. As Malcolm Gladwell pointed out, the family who has more and more money, it does not result in more and more happiness because it provides more opportunities for more challenges. And that really is what Moshe is warning, as the Jewish people are going to step out of the desert and into the land of Israel and start their own nation, he's warning them about the challenge, not of poverty and not the challenge of dealing with tremendous threats of anti-Semitic, angry neighboring tribes and nations, but it's the challenge of wealth, luxury, leisure time. And he's saying that's going to result in becoming completely intoxicated in their own success, overwhelmed by a tremendous amount of consumerism and materiality, which of course will result in a denying that God had anything to do with it, and ultimately will allow them to get into the various superstitions and religions and fantasies of the time. And that's, of course, you know, that's happened many times in Jewish history. And that's what the poem of Azinu talks about. But just to focus on the one part of to the metaphor of the betraying son, betraying child, is to the way to neutralize that is to appreciate when we sit there together as a family on Rosh Hashanah, look at the blessings that we have a sense of gratitude. They're not automatic given to us. In a certain sense, God does not owe us anything in a certain sense. So the fact that we have all these different blessings, we have basic amenities, basic needs taken care of. We have family taken. We have the blessing of family. We have the blessing of friends. We have the blessing of community. And not to take these things for granted. And certainly the discretionary free time that we're given, not to waste that, not allow it to go be dissipated into various distractions and fantasies that our society and culture provides so many avenues for, but to use it productively for real human growth. And I want to wish each and every one of you a Shana Tova, healthy, sweet new year. It should be a year of profound growth and insight and breakthroughs. And I look forward to being part of the journey.
What year is it going to be again?
5778.
We're going to party like it's 5778. Okay.
Exactly. All right, guys.
Shana Tova.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shana Tova.